This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is developed with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. And was I ever lucky this past weekend?
Why? What happened?
Well, I was out on this lawn looking for any eggs that the Easter Bunny might have left, and that's when I discovered something.
Wait a minute, Bob. This isn't Easter.
That is so like you, Bill. Always waiting to the last minute for everything. Why do you think you always have such a difficult time getting things done?
Do you think my being blind has anything to do with it?
Did it stop Jacob Bulletin from becoming a doctor? Did it stop Sir John Fielding from becoming the police chief back in London? Or Homer from writing the Iliad and the Odyssey? Or what about some of the people that we've talked with over the last few weeks? Those kind of people that were right around here.
He's right about that, Bill. Remember the accomplishments of people like James Benton?
Head of the Raleigh Blind Bowlers Association.
And his wife, Sharon.
Office supervisor for the county.
Dr. Charles Walker.
Adjunct professor at North Carolina State and runs his own consulting firm.
Myra DeBruhl.
Does medical transcription for Wake Hospital.
Bob Kennedy.
Third-degree black belt in judo and builds furniture.
And Sharon Giovinazzo.
With a power saw.
Wait a minute, Bob. Sharon doesn't build furniture with a power saw.
Well, of course not. Where did you ever get that silly idea? Sharon making furniture with a power saw. She doesn't, does she?
Sharon runs the production center at RLCB. You know all the products and services they provide, all through the efforts of sight-impaired individuals.
That's right, Bill. And don't forget Ed Summers, Alan Radford, Judy Moore, Kristen Miller, and Kathy Brack.
Right. Every one of them has accomplished amazing things, and they don't use their condition as an excuse. Even you, Bill. Do you make any excuses in order not to tune pianos?
Nope. But I do have to get someone else to drive for me.
You know, there's a lot of stress today on self-reliance. Do you ever try to drive yourself?
Of course not. If I can't see, I would be a danger to other people.
You know, that's a lot smarter than some drivers you run into out on the road.
I think the idea is not to run into them.
And you don't, do you?
And neither do I.
You don't go out and hunt Easter eggs either. Well, that really just proves my point. I think the reason you two aren't out there with me looking for Easter eggs is that you always wait until the last minute, and then they're all gone.
But it isn't Easter.
Have you ever tried to go out on Easter and hunt for eggs?
Not for quite a few years.
You see? When you wait until the last minute, there are so many kids out there that you haven't got a chance. Have you looked at yourself lately, Richard? Not as sleek and quick as you used to be. Not the cat's meow. Not the most interesting man in the world. So, the kids beat you to the eggs, and what few you might find have all been stepped on.
So what's your point?
Go now, and beat the rush.
And did you find many eggs?
I found the rabbit hole where the Easter Bunny was storing them.
Bob, think about it for a minute. A rabbit with chicken eggs?
That's why he colors them. Great disguise, isn't it?
And you still believe in the Easter Bunny?
Well, of course. He's my favorite, right next to the Tooth Fairy. Did you know there is a special Tooth Fairy just for dentures? Keep that in mind, Richard.
And you put teeth under your pillow before going to bed?
Well, not right now. I'm saving them.
For what?
When I was a kid, I used to get a dime for a tooth. When my kids came along, they used to get a quarter. Kids today are getting anywhere from $1 to $5 for a tooth. With the rate of inflation, think of what they're going to be worth in a few more years.
I can just imagine.
I even go to hockey games and collect spare teeth that I find laying around after the game.
You go to hockey games and collect teeth?
Bill, don't ask.
That's all right. I can tell now.
Never mind. Bob, if there weren't any eggs around, what did you find?
All kinds of electronic devices, and I think they came from outer space.
Why did you think that?
Because they were all trying to talk with me. There were clocks and calculators and rulers and kinds of things that were beeping and talking to me and just telling me that it's 2 o'clock and that the temperature was 58 degrees and 2 plus 2 is 4. I hadn't had so much fun since my last trip to Roswell.
And where were you?
I was out in back of this one building. I think it was called Haywood. And I thought I saw a rabbit run up this ramp and into an open door. So I followed. And there was a big room where all the gadgets were just talking away.
I know exactly where you were. That's the appliance store on the grounds of the Governor Moorhead School.
Well, of course it was. Why else would Donna Wiggins be there? She was in her office right across the hall. Do you know what kind of appliances they have?
Specially made products for sight-impaired people, since they can't see dials and clock faces and such things.
Don't you remember? We had Donna Wiggins on our show a few weeks ago.
That's right. She told us all about the appliances that they carried at the store.
There are all kinds, designed to assist people with sight impairments to do things just like anybody else.
And she was right. They were all standing there on their shelves, waving their little arms in the air and saying, "Buy me! Buy me!"
I've been in that store lots of times, and I've never seen any of them jumping up and down and waving their arms.
Are you sure?
Bob, you know my situation. If I were to go into that store, it would be impossible for me to see things jumping up and down on shelves, if that's what they were really doing.
Okay, Bill. Then how do you know that Donna Wiggins was there?
Because she talked to me.
Like your watch, telling you what time it was?
No. Donna talked to me because I walked in. My watch? I have to prompt it to speak, just like all the other appliances that I have to make my life easier.
And you bought them there?
Of course I did.
Jumping up and down, waving the little arms, saying, buy me, and he did. Well, there you are, but...
Never mind, Bill. And did you buy anything, Bob?
A pair of oven mittens that reach all the way up to my elbows.
So you won't burn your arms while taking things out of the oven?
No, because they look like rabbits. Here, let me put these gloves on. Notice I drew some things on them. See, Bill, you can feel this. Here's their eyes, and here's their tails running all the way up my arm. Now, they look just like Easter bunnies, don't they? And they can help me find Easter eggs. Here come Peter Cottontail, hopping down the bunny trail.
While Bob is out hunting eggs, let's talk with Deborah Barnes.
Deborah, welcome to Take My Arm.
Thank you.
Tell us about yourself.
Well, I was born in Athens, Georgia, and then we moved to North Carolina when I was very small. I went to the Governor Moorhead School here in Raleigh. I left there in 71. I got married, which was something back then that you could not continue at the school after that. So I left the school in 71, and I ended up going to, or Campbell College as it was back then, also to NC State, where I got some master's training. I did not complete my master's, but I was there for a while. I have spent my life, a lot of my life, in counseling. I was an alcohol rehab counselor for a while. I was also a crisis line counselor and also a rehab counselor. Then, about 1990, I went back to the Library for the Blind. I had been at the library for a while when I had just gotten out of college. And I went back to the Library for the Blind as their Braille coordinator, and I've been there ever since.
Tell me a little bit about your experience at Campbell, because I, too, am a fellow Campbell graduate.
Right.
What was your major in?
I majored in psychology, and I worked while I was there. I did some typing for the ROTC. We lived off campus because we were married, so we didn't really get that involved in a lot of the extracurricular stuff. I loved Campbell. The professors and all were really great as far as I was concerned. I was a whole lot different back then than I am now. So, you know, I probably could have gotten more involved in things than I did, but I was very shy and didn't really get that involved in things, but I loved the experience. And then I did a wonderful practicum, as they called them back then, internship at Falcon Children's Home, and I loved that. It was so much fun. And then we left Campbell and started our careers.
How does the work that you're doing now at the Library for the Blind compare with what you did when you worked there before?
Well, I did the same thing when I was there before, except that it was full-time, and now it's part-time. I do assist sometimes with other volunteer activities, but mostly as Braille coordinator. And now I do a lot more with computers and things like that than I did before.
What does the Braille coordinator do?
Pretty much anything that has to do with Braille. I'm in charge of quality control for our local productions. We have volunteers throughout the state and also in Florida and Charlotte and Wilmington who do Braille for us. I teach the Braille certification course through the Library of Congress. I proofread some of the stuff that comes through the library. And then along with that, I also have contracts with several other agencies because it is a part-time position. So I do other Braille-related things with other agencies throughout the country. I have worked for several companies throughout the United States. I've proofread for Oshkosh Correctional Institute in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. It's primarily textbook-related work. I've also worked with Associated Services for the Blind in Philadelphia. I currently grade manuscripts for people who are asking to be certified by the Library of Congress, and I do that for the National Federation of the Blind. It's a very detailed job, takes up lots and lots of time. So I've done a fair amount of different kinds of things.
How have computers impacted your work at the library?
Oh, lots. You know, there are days I say I wish I was back to the way we used to do it. But the nice thing about the computers is that you can actually do copies of things, you know, much faster and more copies. Once you get it set up for one, you can do 10. Then you can change it if you want to, which is great. Because used to, if you were a volunteer and you typed a page and you made certain kinds of errors, you had to do that page over. You couldn't just hit that key and say, oh, delete that, okay? That's one of the things that I absolutely love about my job now. I can do so many different kinds of things and so much faster to reach the patrons of our state. And that's ultimately what I want. I want our patrons to be able to have the things they need. And that's one of the beauties of my job is to provide things for the patrons who need them.
Deborah, where did you learn the computer skills that you use in transcribing material into Braille?
Me, myself, and I.
School of hard knocks, in other words.
I actually did. I had the computer put on my desk one day, and they said, this is here, and you're going to have to learn to use it. And I had no clue where to start. And we had this wonderful gentleman who worked with me named Teddy. He's retired now, but I love him. I'll always think the world of him. If it had not been for him, I don't know what I would have done. And he would say, it won't break. Try it. And then one day, I didn't have voice. I just had the computer. And one day, I don't remember how exactly I found out about it, but I found out there was something called a screen reader. And so I went and said, how am I expected to do this if I don't have a screen reader? Back then, I wasn't real tactful. So eventually got my screen reader, and it was just fabulous. And then after that, when I'd get something new, I would just sit down with the manual or play with it or something till I got it learned, and I've always learned that way.
Do you use a combination of JAWS and a Braille printer?
I use JAWS, I have a Braille embosser, and I have a wonderful thing called a Braille display. I love my Braille display. And for those who may or may not know what a Braille display is, it sits in front of my keyboard, and I can read it like you would if you were reading a Braille page. So whatever is on the screen comes across my Braille display. And it's wonderful when you're trying to edit. You can just put your fingers on that Braille and just go to town. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing. So that's one of the things I love about the job at the library is I have a Braille display.
How does it work in conjunction with JAWS?
You can actually fix it where you don't have to necessarily hear JAWS while you're doing the Braille display. So I can be totally silent. There have been times people didn't know I was there because it was so quiet. Or you can use it in combination with the speech. Both are great. It's good to have the speech. It's good to have the Braille. And it's good to have both at the same time. I mean, it just depends on what you're doing, I guess, really.
Let's go back to your days as a counselor, Deborah. Do you have some particular success stories that you'd like to share with our listeners?
My favorite job that I ever had in the whole wide world was when I was at the alcohol rehab center. We had this one gentleman there, and he would scare people to death. He was loud, and he was just, and he could use some salty language, and they were just, especially a lot of the young girls, they were scared to death of him. Well, I happened to get him that time when he came through, and I could only be there for 18 months because the program I was employed through, you couldn't be there longer than that. They were like, oh, you're going to have trouble. And y'all, I got to tell y'all, I had the best time. He would sneak off campus and get something to drink. And you could always tell where they were drinking because all the beer bottles and stuff would be down there. They wouldn't go get him because they were scared to go get him. And I'd go get him. And I always knew where to find him. And he could never figure out how I knew where to find him. Well, I mean, you could hear him block away, you know. Anyway, so I would go get him. He was just one that, I don't know, he just, it was just a real special case for me. He had been through several times. You know, he left, and he did pretty good for a while, they said, and he came back to see me right when he found out we were leaving. He came back to see me, and he was actually sober. I thought that was really cool that he was actually sober, because nobody had ever seen him sober before. I'm not sure whatever happened to him, but I just was real impressed by the fact that he was maintained sobriety for a while, because he never had before. And I'm not saying that I did it, but it was just something that really, I really felt kind of special to be a part of that, because he had had some sobriety. Then the other story that I think of a lot, and this one's definitely a success story, we had a gentleman come through the evaluation unit when I was here in Raleigh, and he was an alcoholic as well. Having had my experience at the alcoholic rehab center, I sort of knew what to expect. And everybody said he wasn't going to show up that day, the day he was supposed to come begin his evaluation. They figured, well, he wasn't going to show up. And I said, well, he might. No, he's not going to show up. I bet he's somewhere drunk. And I said, well, we'll see. So he showed up. And he was not drunk. He was my client for, I think it was 18 months. We could do it then, too. And he actually got through the program. He got a job. He bought a house. He got married. He had kids. You know, did all the things that adults do after that. I can't say I did that, but I was a part of it. And I felt real special to be able to help somebody come from the kind of life he was living before and make a better life for himself. So, I mean, you know, it's kind of neat to be able to look at some of those things.
Those are certainly rewarding stories. Tell us something about your blindness. What was the cause of your blindness? Have you always been blind?
Yeah, I was born, they used to call it retinal fibroplasia. Now they call it retinopathy of prematurity, I believe. And I had light perception. When I was about 12 or 13, I had surgery for a cataract, and they weren't sure if it would do any good, and it turned out that it didn't really do that much good, but still I did do that. And also I have a detached retina, which if I hold my head a certain way, I can see more shapes and stuff, but it's not a done thing. Just sometimes I'll get little glimpses of things, but it's not. It's mainly light perception and shadows, that kind of thing. I always just tried to take my blindness as just something that I had to deal with. But the one thing, I guess, that has been a challenge really more in the past, I'd say, 4 or 5 years than probably in any other time in my life, it's getting things read in a timely manner and getting things filled out in a timely manner and finding out about things when it was way past the time you probably needed to know about them, so that you could handle them in a timely manner. Those have been some of the challenges in the past 4 or 5 years that have really caused me to step back and look at things and go, well, you didn't used to have these problems, and so then I had to figure out ways of dealing with them. People used to ask me, was I bitter because I couldn't see, and I used to laugh at them because I'd say no. Because I was blind, I've done things that if I had lived where I did, I would have never done. I've been able to meet people and do some of the neatest things in my life. I mean, I know it sounds kind of strange, but I've probably had more of a life because I was visually impaired than I would have had living where I did if I had been sighted. If I look at some of the other people I grew up with and the way they've had to live, I'm a very lucky girl from my point of view.
Deborah, can you elaborate a little bit on how your blindness has made you a better person?
When I went to the Governor Moorhead School, I met people with all different kinds of opinions, different walks of life. I learned to look at things in a more positive manner than perhaps I would have. I learned to take people where they were, and I learned to really think about the other person. And I had someone tell me one time that I was the most amazing person they'd ever seen because I was able to see both sides of a situation. And I think that happened because I saw people as I was growing up from a different set of references than I would have if I had stayed home, because I saw people go through so many different experiences, and I learned to take them for where they were. I'll give you sort of an example. I don't know if you can use this one. But when I was 18 years old, I had to take the bus back and forth to work. And I was always either getting lost or I had a driver wanting to put me off in the wrong place. Well, there were some people on the bus who would help me, and there were other people on the bus who wouldn't. And the people on the bus who would help me were not always the kinds of people that I grew up with and that my family would allow me to communicate with and have anything to do with. And if I hadn't had an open mind and hadn't accepted their help and said thank you and been pleasant to everybody on that bus, I might have found myself in a mess a million times. I think I've been a lot more open-minded. And then the other thing I think it also has made a difference, I know that if I had been able to see, unless I had had a miracle, I would never have been able to go to college. I would never have had the background in music that I've had, all kinds of music. I would have never gotten into all that, probably.
Tell us about your hobby.
Oh, I forgot about hobbies. Okay, well, of course, I love to read. I love the new digital player that the Library for the Blind has. I just absolutely love that thing. I used to love to cook. I don't cook as much as I used to, but I love to read, love to cook. I love music, all kinds of music. But I guess the hobby that I do the most is knitting. I've dabbled in a few other craft-related things like beads and so forth. But knitting seems to be the thing that I have stuck with the most. For anybody out there who wants to get more involved with crafts and with people who are blind and visually impaired or other handicaps, there is an organization that you can do that with, and it's a wonderful little organization. The website is crafterscorner.org. Now, this is spelled a little differently. It's crafters with a K and corner with a K, so it's crafters, crafterscorner, all together, .org. That's the website. And you can go on there and you can see the classes that are scheduled for right now. I found out about last year, and it has just been so much fun because you can teach it if you know how to teach crafts, or you can just take the classes and learn and get patterns or do whatever. You know, it's really a lot of fun.
Is there any cost to this?
For the chats, there is no cost. For the email list, there is no cost. If you take the classes, the first class is free, because that gives you an idea if you think you would like something like that. After that, if you pay your $10 annual National Federation of the Blind fee, then you can take as many classes as you wish, and you can be as active as you want. And they have beading, they have crochet, they have knitting. Anybody who's involved in the crafts can be on the list. So it's really fun.
Well, Deborah, do you have a final comment that you'd like to share with our listeners?
It's very hard sometimes to have a positive attitude when life gets tough, but I have to tell you, we get farther by being positive than we do if we let it all bring us down and keep us down. We got to keep popping back up and just keep going and keep fighting what you got to fight through. Hopefully you're going to come out on top and everything's going to be all right.
Thank you, Deborah, for being our guest today on Take My Arm.
It's time again for the TRRS Radio Theater on the Air with Bill McClure, Richard Dunnigan, and Bob Martin with another episode of
Blind Justice.
The scene opens with Bill sitting around the old homestead up in Rutherford County. He's sitting on the front porch playing his flute.
Sorry. I'll move around to the back of the house. I'll go inside and close the windows.
Oh, for Pete's sake, stop a sock in it. I'm trying to watch TV, and I can't even hear the guy announcing the soccer from Mexico City say, "Go!"
I'm sorry, but I need to practice.
You don't need to practice. You need something else to do besides sitting around all day long playing that silly horn.
It's a flute.
Why don't you go out and get a job?
I have a job. I tune pianos and I'm the organist at my church.
The kind of a job that'll get you away from the house on my day off.
How about something down at your shop? There are a lot of things I could do.
In your condition? I couldn't afford the liability. Just go somewhere else.
I'll go down to the park at the edge of town. That's far away from everybody.
Run for your lives! Run for your lives! Bigfoot is coming!
What is Bigfoot? And why should we run?
Haven't you been watching TV?
No.
Well, maybe you ought to instead of playing that dumb horn all the time.
I'll certainly try to do that in the future.
March 24th, 2011. Fox News broadcast the sighting of this huge, horrible, smelly beast crossing the Golden Valley Church Road down in Shelby. They just interrupted the soccer game to announce that he's heading this way. Well, come on, run for your life.
What has he done that is so bad?
What has he done? What hasn't he done? He's broken down fences and torn down mailboxes. He went through a field, grabbed a sheep, and ate it whole. He went across a pasture, grabbed a cow, and ate it whole. Lucky he hasn't caught a person yet or they'd be gone. Ooh, and he stinks.
And you saw all of this on Fox News?
I told you they interrupted my soccer game. Oh, and here he comes.
Where?
He's right over there, coming this way. Woo! Look at the size of him. Run.
Play.
What?
Play more.
Bigfoot is talking?
Shush.
Yes, he's Bigfoot.
Who, me? Bigfoot? No, I'm just me from Paradise Mountain. I came down this way years ago, and everybody run me off. Said I was no good. Wouldn't let me work with them. So I left and went up in the hills by myself. But I missed the music. Play it again.
Bigfoot is sitting down at that old piano, and I think he wants to join in.
Take my arm, stand with me, and together we will see how the world was meant to be. Take my arm, take my arm.
Hey, you're good. Say, why don't you come back into town? We have a show down at the auditorium this Saturday night, and oh, they could use you.
You mean you want me?
Well, we'll stop by the river first, and I'll lend you a razor and a pair of overalls. But yes.
And me?
Well, of course you too. We have to have that song.
Saturday night. Won't that interrupt your soccer game?
Oh, forget the soccer. The Packers are playing the next day. I never realized what you could do.
I never had the chance.
Well, that's going to change. I'm the mayor of this town, and I'll see to that.
Do I get the razor and the overalls, too?
What are you talking about?
I guess it's one step at a time.
Not anymore, partner. Not anymore.
Thank you, partner. Looks like we just made the big time.
As it should have been a long time ago on...
Blind Justice.
Bob, you sounded pretty enthused about the accomplishments of the local people that we have interviewed during our shows.
How can you not be? Some of the things that they've done has been amazing.
Remember, Bill has told us several times that all blind people want is a chance, and given that chance, we might be amazed at what they can do.
Would you like some more examples?
Let's ask Dr. Bill, if you don't mind.
Just plain Bill can't do it for you?
Well, what if they really were jumping up and down, waving their little arms? He might miss them. Dr. Bill won't.
It's time for Insights with Dr. Bill.
This is Dr. Bill. What's on your mind?
Dr. Bill, we were talking about some of the accomplishments of the blind people we've interviewed, and Bob was wondering about other famous people with vision impairments and the things they have done.
We know about Louis Braille and Helen Keller and Homer. What about some other people in history?
Richard and I were talking about this, and we remembered some people that you might not have even thought were visually impaired.
For instance?
How about Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
The former president? Well, I knew he had polio, but I didn't know he had vision problems, too.
Our 32nd president had several physical problems, including impaired vision, but that didn't keep people from electing him 4 times during the Second World War, and those were some pretty stressful times.
Another politician was Thomas Gore. He became blind as a child, but never gave up his dream of becoming a senator.
In 1907, he was one of the first 2 senators from the new state of Oklahoma and was respected enough to be reelected 2 times.
How about painters who are visually impaired?
I can't imagine that the results would look like much.
Well, think Claude Monet.
The Impressionist was visually impaired? Well, it must have been later in his life.
Not really. By 1907, he was world famous, but at the same time, he was starting to have eye problems. He had glaucoma, but continued to paint and did one of his most famous murals of water lilies while he was almost completely blind.
Another famous artist who developed eye problems was Degas. He spent the last 20 years of his life as a blind recluse.
There were a lot of blind musicians, weren't there?
2 of the most well-known are Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder.
Also, there is classically trained Andrea Bocelli.
He was blinded at age 12 from a football accident, but continued with his training and has sung with operatic star Luciano Pavarotti.
Bob mentioned that the Greek poet Homer was blind, but so was John Milton. Many people know his poem On His Blindness.
That's the one that ends, "They also serve who only stand and wait."
Right. But he also composed, through dictation, his most famous work, Paradise Lost, after he had lost his eyesight.
And there have been great achievements in athletics. Look at Eric Weihenmayer.
What sport does he participate in?
Several. He's an acrobatic skydiver, a rock climber, a mountaineer, an ice climber, a skier, and a marathon runner.
I was about to say, what about ordinary people? But just because you're not an athlete, a musician, or a painter, you are not ordinary. So, what about Harriet Tubman?
Blinded by a blow to her head, she pursued a life battling for the rights and freedom of slave people.
And those are just some of the things that can happen when you give people a chance.
You know something, Dr. Bill? I think I know where all those accomplishments are stored.
Where's that, Bob?
They're not really somewhere out of sight. They're right over there.
Good point, Bob. And you don't need me to remind you of that. You could have asked just plain Bill. I taught him everything I know.
And so ends another episode of Insights with Dr. Bill. Conversations. the voices of TRRS. We're here today with George Burrell. George is a volunteer at Triangulated Reading Service. George, we had a little discussion about if I'm pronouncing your name correct, and you kind of laughed. You want to tell me what that's about?
Yeah. The Scottish pronunciation of my name is Burrell. And I had always thought that's what it was until I was walking down the gangplank in New York Harbor. And the customs guy looked at my papers and said, "Ah, Burrell." And I said, "Golly." Well, I didn't say golly, I used another word, but that's an easier way to pronounce it. So, here it's George Burrell.
Well, obviously, by now we hear that you do have a little bit of an accent. Tell us a little bit about your background and where you're from.
Okay. Well, I was born in Aberdeen, brought up in Perth, and living in Edinburgh in Scotland before coming to North America. Since crossing the Atlantic, I had 10 years in the United States, 4 in Canada, 10 years back in the U.S., 6 in England, which is different from Scotland, and then 2.5 years in Hong Kong, 2 years in Malaysia, and then back to the United States to retire.
And when did you consider that the United States is now your home?
I guess maybe the moment of that was our daughter was coming to visit us on a holiday in Kuala Lumpur, and she said, "On the last day of my holiday, the last evening, we will sit down and you will decide where you're going to retire to." So we had a discussion, and it was either going to be the Triangle or it was going to be up in the hills in Asheville. We like the hills and that up there, but it's kind of a smaller community. We thought the Triangle had a much broader community, and here we are.
You said you've retired, so tell me about what kind of work you did that took you on all of those places.
My major areas of teaching and research and consultancy were in construction management, real estate development, project management, general management. Before that, I was something called a British Chartered Quantity Surveyor, which is a role that doesn't exist in North America, but is a highly qualified, educated, trained expert in the running of construction projects for the client, not by the general contractor, but for the client, in real estate advice, in interacting on construction advice, in the design process, doing all the construction contract documents, and then running the affairs of the client and settling up all the accounts, change orders, etc., at the end of the job.
Did you work on any particular projects that we might be familiar with?
This was back in Scotland, and before I moved into university life, I was running these services on the three largest construction projects in and around Edinburgh at that time. But since being in North America, I've primarily been in the academic field, teaching and researching, and doing consultancy and bits and pieces of work for different people.
Now tell me a little bit about your family.
My wife and I live here in the Triangle. We've been here for about 7 or 8 years. I think it was the November day in which George Bush won his second term as president that we moved into our house.
It was a day you can remember because of that.
Well, the moving into a house was very memorable. I don't know if that was a particular addition.
So you mentioned children. Are your children in the United States?
Yes, our daughter was born in Detroit and now works in Baltimore. When we came back to the U.S. to retire, she was working in Tampa, and we stayed with her a little bit, but that was a rather upsetting for everybody sort of lifestyle, and we moved up to North Carolina to retire.
So you're fully retired at this point?
Well, if you call retirement doing nothing, that's wrong. But if you call retirement not working for a paycheck, then yes.
I think there's a lot of people not working for a paycheck now. Well. Now, you were telling me about some of the things you're working on sort of as a hobby or sort of as a special interest, the writing, the poems. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, actually, I've been giving readings of Scottish poetry in classes and to groups, but also been running a Scottish Ceilidhs. That's a concert of Scottish cultural events, singing, dancing, music, stories, poetry. Also, I have been writing, because I wrote a lot of academic stuff. I enjoy writing, I enjoy editing, and what I've been doing is taking Scottish poems and writing a little commentary on each to give a little bit of background about the situation, the context of the poem, poet themselves, or that part of Scotland, and gathering a number of these to probably put it out as a book. And I limit the size of these down to 2 pages max for the poem and the commentary. I'm doing another set of those on one particular poet, William Souter from Perth, the town in which I was brought up. And he has lots of wonderful little stories for children. They're like a Scottish Aesop's fables. And I've been taking these, adding the English words, and I've been writing a little commentary on those, and each of those is one page. And I'm thinking that'd be a wonderful tool for education in Scotland, where young people get old Scottish words, but also get some advice about living and life and problems they may face so they can think about it in the first place.
Now, I was asking you some questions. Explain the relationship of Scotland and what it's like, you know, in that between all that area. We see it as just one area, but there's quite some distinction.
The United Kingdom and Ireland, or EIRE, E-I-R-E, which is Southern Ireland, that's a separate country. But the United Kingdom comprises England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And these four comprise what is the United Kingdom, which was the foundation or the source of all enterprise and activities of the British Empire and the British Commonwealth. This, as a united kingdom, is perhaps more in words than in reality. There is Scotland, there is England, there is Wales, and there is Ireland, and they are different. The Celtic fringe, the Welsh, the Irish, and the Scots have a bond together, and the English are really a mixture of masses of diverse peoples from all over Europe, but who have settled in England and been there for a long time. There's invariably an enmity between Scotland and England, just as there is between Wales and England and Ireland and England. So you maybe get a little sense of the relationships there. Up until maybe 10 years ago, they were all under the same government. But about that time, Scotland regained its own parliament after 300 years of being combined into the United Kingdom Parliament. And they were given limited powers for self-rule, but not completely by any means. They're still part of the United Kingdom. Now, interestingly enough, the Parliament in its setup was designed to almost make it impossible for other than the normal political parties in the United Kingdom to survive. But the voting power in Scotland went against that, and now almost, I know the exact numbers, but 90% of the Scottish Parliament is of members from the Scottish Independent Party, not the Labour Party or the Conservative Party or the Liberal Party, which are the normal political parties in the UK. In 2014, there is supposed to be a referendum in Scotland as to whether to go for independence. Now, it all depends what you mean by independence. There are all sorts of gradations of independence. How the question is asked and what powers will be devolved from the central government of the United Kingdom to Scotland if it goes for it or not. I tend to think that the Scots leadership will want overtly to go for independence in order to gain as much as possible of benefits for Scotland from the United Kingdom, but still remain in it. A bit like the Quebecois in Canada, how they operated to gain more power in the sort of overall sense of Canada. And this is a wonderfully interesting time in Scotland about all of these possible evolutions.
Now, we certainly enjoy hearing your accent as a reader here at Triangle Radio Reading Service, so let's find out a little bit about how long you have been reading here, what you read, and what brought you to find out about TRRS and led you to want to be a part.
Okay, take the last bit first.
Okay.
I had been talking to a woman in the Triangle about poetry and readings and stuff like that and got some advice about that. Shortly thereafter, I got a phone call from Kurt Benrood, who had been speaking to this woman, and she had said, hey, you might want to contact this guy. And so that's how I got sort of sucked into this exercise, which is very enjoyable.
How long ago was that?
Oh, probably about a year ago. I think I've been going for about a year. I've been reading as the second reader in the evenings most of the time.
So in the evening you're reading the
USA Today.
Okay.
Yeah.
George, if you remember, you were part of a training class that I helped lead, but you remember you were instructed not to editorialize and add personal comments?
Yeah.
Well, here you have a microphone. Is there something you would like to say to the listeners? And what would you say?
Okay. First of all, a confession. I once did a little bit of ad-libbing. I was reading an article about the troubles in Libya, and I happened to have been there on the World Bank mission early in the time of the Gaddafi regime. I met some wonderful people, and I just said that I was very concerned for some of these wonderful people in this terrible situation they were in. I would think what might be useful information about what are the reactions of the listeners about this program and what the services they get and what would they like. 832-5138. If you have some ideas of what should be in these programs, call that number, 832-5138, and tell them, because this is the way to improve the accuracy or the fit of the program to the listeners.
George, thank you very much, and you definitely are a nice addition as one of the readers here of Triangle Radio Reading Services. Nice talking to you.
Okay, good fun. I enjoy the service.
It's time again for the TRRS Radio Theater on the Air with Bill McClure, Kimberly McClure, Richard Dunnigan, and Bob Martin in another episode of
Blind Justice.
The scene opens with Bill getting out of the car at the hospital. He is here to pick up his wife, and Richard has driven him. I'll bet you'll sure be glad to have Jean back home again.
You better believe it. I'm tired of trying to follow Adeline Radford's recipes from his cooking shows.
You mean that you're tired of cooking for yourself and you want Jean back in the kitchen?
Is it that obvious?
Yes. Anyway, what did they find out?
Absolutely nothing wrong. All those tests just to find out that she's allergic to salt water.
Salt water? You haven't been down to the ocean with her before?
Not recently. I think her heritage had begun to creep up on her.
Her heritage?
Yes. You know she had traced her ancestors back to Norway.
What has that got to do with salt water?
She may have been pining for the fjords.
Oh, Bill. I can't believe you said that.
Actually, she was just here as part of a study, and they had to run a bunch of tests. It's just, well, that I miss her.
Her or her cooking?
After all these years together, they go together.
Go get her, Bill. I'll be right here when you get back.
Thanks, Richard. All right. I've been down this way enough times in the past few days. There it is. Okay. Down the ramp, through the doors, to the elevator. Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah. Someone's in the kitchen, I know. I guess I do miss her cooking. Fourth floor. Now, down the aisle to room 417. Jean, here's the bed and her suitcase on top. She must be ready to go. Jean? Jean?
In a minute.
Oh, she's in the bathroom. I'll just sit here on the bed and wait.
Sir, are we waiting to go home?
Well, I am. I don't know about you.
Oh, a little stressed about our stay here, aren't we? Do we have someone to pick us up?
I have someone waiting for me in the parking lot. Yes, as soon as...
Oh, tut-tut-tut-tut now. No more as soon as. You know the hospital rules. We have other people who need these facilities.
I'm waiting for my...
Ride! But you said they are down in the parking lot.
I'm waiting for my...
Wheelchair to assist us to the parking lot?
No, I...
Have to get our suitcase. Oh, but of course, sir. It will fit right next to you in the wheelchair.
But it's...
Not your intent to cause any trouble. After all, you have been treated to the best of care, and you want to express your gratitude for the helpful care that you have received.
No.
No, of course. You can't leave a gratuity for me. That's against hospital rules. But here is a card here on which you can leave your evaluation. May we suggest strongly approve? And my name is Bob.
But I'm not the one.
That should be making the evaluation? Oh, sir, you are so kind. We will be talking with your relatives for similar evaluations. In the meantime, you just wait right here while I go get a wheelchair to assist you to the hospital exit.
Good grief! Gene! Gene!
In a minute.
It had better be less than a minute, or else that nurse will be...
Going to get you out of here in just two passes of a surgeon's scalpel. Why don't we just climb up here in the wheelchair?
Wheelchair?
Well, sir, it's right over here. And as we say on the fourth floor, we'll be sailing on down to debarkation. Toot, toot!
Wait a minute. I'm waiting for...
Your final billing? Oh, no, sir. I've got your clearance papers right here, and we're on our way.
But what about my...
Balance? Your insurance will be billed for the balance.
Good grief!
Oh, there's no grief here, sir. It's just part of my job. And just between you and me, I've received the highest proficiency rating for the past month.
And before that?
Sir, that isn't necessary. Well, here we are, ground floor. Down the aisle, past the gift shop. Want to stop for any last remembrances?
I don't have any first remembrances.
Oh, we do have the sense of humor now, don't we? Well, here we are. Where's our ride?
It's right over there, I think.
We have to wait? Well, you could have been more considerate and called ahead. You expect me to walk over there and tell them that we are ready?
No, but I might have expected...
That I would make the call for you? Well, really, sir.
How about my wife?
Your wife? What has she got to do with you keeping me waiting down here in the parking lot?
She's still up in room 417.
And what is she doing up there?
Waiting for me to pick her up.
Why should she wait up there?
Where else should she wait? She's being released today.
You're not the patient?
No. She's the one getting out of the hospital.
Would we mind standing up for a minute? I need the wheelchair and, sir, forget about the evaluation card.
So ends another episode of... Blind Justice.
Do we have enough time for a visit with Professor Bill?
I think that can be arranged.
It's time now for Outside the Box with Professor Bill. The problem. A woman goes into a hardware store to buy something for her house. The clerk in the store tells her that they have what she needs. Next, she asks the price. The clerk tells her that one will cost 12 cents, 57 would cost 24 cents, and 140 would cost 36 cents. What is she buying?
Well, whatever it is, the more she buys, the cheaper it gets.
Not necessarily.
Of course. Richard said that one would cost 12 cents. But if she bought 57 of them, the price was 24 cents. That's not even a penny apiece. And when you get up to 140, well, that's a... Well, not very much.
So, what is she buying?
Whatever it is, I'll buy a bunch of them and then sell them door to door for 12 cents each.
Bob, if you did that, you wouldn't make any money at all. If May wanted this for the studio,
she'd buy 213 and pay 36 cents.
Bill, remember I told you once that there are three kinds of people in this world? Those who know how to count and those who don't? Now, how could she buy 213 of them for the same price as someone else paid for 140?
And there are also some people who think that there are three kinds of people in this world, and some who don't.
What?
You're concentrating on quantities. Think about the kind of things she might be buying. What's the address of our studio?
213 Six Forks Road, Suite 103.
So, if May wanted to put up the 213...
she'd pay 36 cents. And if she wanted to add the 103, she'd pay another 36 cents.
Oh, house numbers. And each of the numbers of the address costs 12 cents. That means for my house, I'd have to pay... Well, wait a minute. I can't remember my address. I wonder which one of those three kinds of people that makes me.
I'm not sure we have enough creative thinking to figure out that problem. Not even from... Outside the Box. Anything else?
One last thing. I think I'm going to give up on the Easter Bunny.
Why's that?
I already have my oven mittens that reach up to my elbows, and I was thinking about what you and Richard said concerning rabbits and chicken eggs, so I'm not going to follow rabbits around anymore.
Good thinking, Bob.
No, I'm going right to the source. I'm going looking for the Easter chickens.
The Easter what?
Chickens.
But why?
Well, think, Bill. Wherever there are Easter eggs, there's got to be chickens. Wherever there are chickens, there's got to be hen's teeth. And considering how rare hen's teeth are, all I have to do is just find a few. And boy, is that tooth fairy going to be surprised.
Some last thoughts. The following are from Aesop.
Never trust the advice of a man in difficulty.
Persuasion is often more effectual than force.
The gods help them that help themselves.
Be content with your lot. One cannot be first in everything.
I see many hoof marks going in. I see none coming out. It is easier to get into the enemy's toils than out again.
It is only fine feathers that make fine birds.
This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And thank you for listening in to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is designed with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. The programming of the Triangle Radio Reading Service is available through the use of specially tuned subchannel receivers that are made available to anyone who is print or visually impaired by calling 919-832-5138.
Or you can listen to us on the Internet by going to TriangleReadingService.org and clicking on either the Listen Now prompt for programs currently being broadcast or on the podcast prompt for previously recorded shows.
If you're able to help underwrite our programming, your assistance would be much appreciated for keeping us on the air. Again, just call 919-832-5138.
Until next week,
goodbye.